First case today is case number 69308, Navy Federal Credit Union versus Saticoy Bay. Let's see. Can we proceed? Did you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, if I could, approximately 5 minutes.
Okay, I'll take a look at the clock.
First of all, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Greg Wilde from the law firm of Tiffany & Bosco. I represent the appellant, Navy Federal Credit Union. This case involves one of many homeowner association lien cases before this court, where the purchaser is arguing that the lien sale abrogated a previously recorded deed of trust. On January 26, 2017, this court recently made its ruling in Saticoy Bay, Durango versus Wells Fargo, case number 68630. In that case, the court ruled that NRS 116 did pass the constitutional muster, so I won't be addressing any constitutional arguments today. One more housekeeping matter. Opposing counsel and I prepared an agreement and submitted it to the court, withdrawing my client's argument from the supremacy clause. The events leading to this particular sale started in 2012, so this is one of the early cases in this arena. The sale actually took place 1 year before your SFR decision. I'd like you to keep that in mind today. Also, please keep in mind that the lower court made its ruling during a Rule 56 motion for summary judgment, and the court should have looked at the facts, the evidence, and drawn reasonable inferences in the light most favorable to Navy Federal. We believe that the first error committed was in the recitals. The lower court judge treated them as absolute and conclusive. Such an interpretation flies in the face of the SFR decision, where this court allowed entities to look into sales to make sure they were done correctly.
Was there an attempt to proffer evidence as to your position as to the recitals and problems with those recitals?
Yes, we argued that by looking at the recitals that they do not mention priority, super priority. They contain waiver language stating that the purchaser is taking them subject to any possible secured or unsecured liens. My argument is that at the time, it was a situation where nobody knew what they were selling. Again, this is a case early on. So we did argue that the recitals, that the court should look through the recitals and consider the evidence that my client was attempting to put before it. But in addition,
so what evidence of unfairness, oppression, or fraud, or defective notice did you put forward in the district court?
First of all, we argued the complete lack of information in the notices, as we've mentioned. But
the notices told you when and where and what the foreclosure amount was, correct?
That's correct. But also, there was a huge gap. Let me find that. That's in the timeline. The notice of default was recorded in August of 2012, and the notice of sale was recorded in February of 2013. So there was a 5 month gap. Then the original sale date was set for March 14th, 2013. But the sale didn't actually take place until September 16th of 2013. So again, there's a 6 month gap. And my client would like an opportunity to put evidence before the court of what happened during that time.
Well, but didn't the court give you a 56F relief? It said, look, we're going to give you time to have discovery on the issues you want to bring forward. Please go do your discovery and come back. And then they came back and renewed the motion for summary judgment after you had that discovery. Am I confusing your case with someone else's?
No, you're not. We did take and again, I'm diving deep into the facts, and I also have many cases, and I apologize if it takes...
Yeah, no need to apologize. I'm just trying to nail down what's going on.
Yes, that is the case. We did take the deposition of Eddie Haddad, and we did subpoena the records from the homeowners association that conducted the sale. But again, my client would like the opportunity to put the homeowners association sale agent on the stand and ask it exactly what it thought it was selling at the time. And we also supplied...
Did anybody prevent you from taking that deposition during the 56F window?
No, they did not. Again, and Eddie Haddad testified, and we put this evidence before the court, that he allowed lenders to pay the property taxes even after the sale took place. So again, I just think it was a time when nobody knew exactly what they were selling. Another error that we'd like to address with the court is we believe the lower court should have looked at the commercial reasonableness of the sale. The lower court specifically found that commercial reasonableness is not an issue in an HOA foreclosure case.
Now, I think Judge Kadish made that decision before our Shadowwood case came down.
That's correct.
So I think I understand your point on that. I guess our question, Mr. Weil, is since Shadowwood has come down, how should it impact cases that where the sales have already happened before the case? How should we interpret that and apply Shadowwood?
Well, I think the court, I know it's going to cause a lot of litigation or renewed litigation in the lower courts, but I think that lenders should have an opportunity to look at that and have those issues considered by the lower court.
Let me ask you this on that point, and I'm looking at the district court judge's findings of fact and the decision on the summary judgment. My question to you is going to be, what is the difference in your mind between commercial unreasonableness in this setting and fraud, oppression, or unfairness under the Long versus Town Shadowwood case, because although the district court made the statement it wasn't going to consider commercial unreasonableness, it quite clearly allowed you to put forward that there was fraud, oppression, or unfairness. And I'm not clear that there's any difference between, in a real estate setting, commercial unreasonableness and fraud, oppression, or unfairness with low price. I don't see that in your briefs, that's clearly articulated, and the people on the other side are saying, look, they're very close to the same thing.
I think what you're asking me is essentially the inadequate price becomes a fairness issue. Is that what
Yes, the restatement type position that an inadequate price, if it's below 20%, can itself be a badge of fraud, unfairness, or oppression. I mean, that's kind of the question left open in Shadowwood. But I'm asking you a slightly different question, which is there a difference between commercial unreasonableness and oppression, unfairness, and fraud? And if so, what is it?
Well, I've always considered the Shadowwood test both. You have to look at both. You have to determine if there's been a gross inadequate price. And that's not alone. I mean, I'm to state that. That's not enough to set aside a sale. You have to find unfairness, oppression, fraud. And in this particular case, we're right on the cusp of that 20% mark that the court...
It was about 28%, but going to that, what authority did you cite that would mandate that look or the incorporation of any part of the UCC in this under the 116?
My brief did not cite that, Your Honor. I think the court, again, I can look, but I don't think I went into that in my brief, and I apologize for that oversight. But the court mentioned it was 28%. The amount bid at sale was $32,800.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
The amount bid at sale was $32,800. The fair market value that the purchaser put on the transfer tax declaration was $149,574. So, again, I think the math is 21.9%. The amount bid at the sale was 21.9% of the purported value of the property.
Do you think that Shadowwood leaves open the possibility that, say, it had been sold for 15% of value, that alone would be sufficient?
I think it does. I think it puts somebody on notice that they couldn't be a bona fide purchaser because of a price that low. And you're right, I don't know how low one has to go to reach that inadequate price or the gross inadequate price. Again, I think that's very subjective. Thank you.
Can I just follow up on Mr. Wild before you?
Oh, yes.
I'd like to follow up on Justice Pickering's question of you. I'm not sure that it was answered, and so I just want to follow up on it. I understood her question to be that the judge in the order seemed to reject a finding of oppression or fraud because none was presented. And yet you had an opportunity to investigate that in the 56F. Is that right?
Well, I think that we're not arguing that there was any fraud. We did look into that. But we are arguing that we did present evidence of unfairness in the notices of themselves. The fact of the inadequate price, I think, is a fairness issue. Our argument is that the lower court didn't take a deep enough dive and look into that or allow my client to put the sale agent on the stand to argue and see exactly what they were selling.
So in the category of unfairness, the argument to the district court was price and problems associated with the notice. And I guess those problems dealt specifically with deficiencies in the notice of what they were selling?
That's correct. And also just, again, the general unfairness at the time. Again, that because it was a year before the SFR decision.
What's unfair about that?
Well, as I've stated previously, that it's my opinion and my argument that nobody knew exactly what they were selling at the time.
Okay.
Right. Thank you.
Ms. Gilbert?
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice Cherry, Associate Justices, Jacqueline Gilbert on behalf of Santacoy Bay Summer Point. And this court should affirm the lower court for the very reasons that you've discussed already. First, there's no genuine issue of material fact regarding fraud, oppression, or unfairness, especially after 56F relief was granted.
What about as it relates to commercial reasonableness?
Your Honor, I believe that in this, to the questions that were raised about commercial reasonableness, commercial reasonableness is a standard that comes under the UCC, and it goes on, if you look at levers, it goes under what is the method, manner, time, place, method, manner, time, place, and terms of a sale. And under the UCC, that makes sense because you may be selling perishables, you may be selling durable goods. So you have to look, they can be different in any case. Here we're talking real property. And every single one of those is addressed in the statute. In other words, you have that there has to be a default. The default has to be noticed, the delinquency notice to the, and I'm talking about the statute as existed, notice to the homeowner. Here they actually recorded the notice of delinquent assessments. Then, at least, I believe 30 days later, there has to be a recording of a notice of default, which has to be sent to all affected parties, including junior lien holders like the bank. And here there's evidence that the bank actually received the notice and did nothing. That what the content of the notice is prescribed by statute. Then, at least a minimum of no less than 90 days later, a notice of sale must be recorded and sent to the parties in interest, including junior lien holders of record like the bank. And here there's evidence that the bank actually received the notice, was mailed to and received the notice. and the content of those notices is prescribed by statute. And finally, how the sale is to be conducted is in the statute. It has to be publicly noticed. It had to be posted in three places. It had to be published for 3 weeks in a row. Had to be held in a, had to say, the notices had to say where it was taken, the place that people could attend, and at what time.
Are there any cases that apply commercial reasonableness to the foreclosure setting beyond the extent to which you have sort of the Long versus Town unfairness, oppression, or fraud plus grossly inadequate price metric? In other words, does that doctrine add anything analytically to the statutes you've just described and the equitable cases?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. What you look at is if they're similar. What you have is a similar concept. In other words, you take the statute, and if everything was done by the statute, and there was nothing, no fraud, oppression, or unfairness in the process of the sale or the sale itself, the conduct of the sale, and the cases that look at what designates that, this court actually looked at, but you look at, was there fraud, oppression, or unfairness as to the conduct of the sale? And then you take that with the price, and this court looked at the potential of grossly inadequate price, but didn't adopt that as a measure in and of itself. Long v. Town, both have rejected gross inadequacy of price in and of itself. And it has to be the two combined. And if there is no evidence of anything like that, then the sale should not be set aside. And when you look at some of the out-of-state cases, or even some of the...
That's what I'm asking about. Are there out-of-state cases that treat those as separate?
No, I think they all look at it as inadequacy of price or gross inadequacy of price, plus there are a few jurisdictions that look at it as simply saying shocks the conscience, but this court expressly rejected it. Arizona, I believe, rejected, but this court has expressly rejected that standard and Golden v. Tamiyasu. So it's the combination. It's similar. I'm just saying that what you would look for commercial reasonableness is prescribed by statute. In other words, how was the sale conducted? And then you look at, was there anything that impacted that sale that accounted for the price, which is what was discussed in the California decision, where we adopted the standard to begin with. I think they're very similar. What you're looking at is, because you're not changing the type of product, you're simply looking at what was the how was the sale conducted, and that's prescribed by the statute. You don't have to look at the difference between perishables and durables.
Ms. Cooper, just one question. I was looking at the findings by Judge Kadish. So she indicated in finding 5 that the foreclosure agent received a recorded copy of the notice of delinquent assessment. So was it clear in the district court that there was notice to Mr. Wild's clients directly or indirectly through an agent? Was any type of disputed fact raised?
No, there is no disputed fact at all. As a matter of fact, if you look at page, when we talk to agent, we're talking about the recorded, the people on the deed of trust. If you look at
the beneficiaries, or who
yeah,
is
the beneficiaries
it?
On the record, and here, actually, Navy Federal Credit Union was the lender and the beneficiary on the deed of trust.
Okay, and it says they received a copy of the notice by certified mail. So that
yes, and that's okay. And that actually can be found on page, I believe, 54 of the record for the notice of default, and on page 64 and 65 of the record for the notice of sale.
Okay, thank you.
So there, we have actual notice. We have a bank that did nothing. And they were given 56F relief specifically to look for fraud, oppression, and unfairness. I understand this is a pre-Shadowood case, and a pre-Shadowood order. But the district court did exactly what you would have expected, which is, was this a fair sale? Was there fraud, oppression, or unfairness? Are there any facts that even suggested? And in the absence of any facts such as that, then there is no reason to do a Shadowood balancing analysis. There is no evidence. And therefore, they cannot show that their deed of trust survived or should survive this sale in any way, shape, or form, or that the sale should be unwound.
I think your opponent's argument is that the uncertainty in the legal landscape depressed price values at these foreclosure sales to such an extent that the sale was inherently unfair. I don't think he articulates it quite that way, but that's kind of what I'm understanding. Could you comment on that?
Yes, Your Honor. What happened, I believe, is, and if you look at this, now you're looking at something like a BFP v. Resolution Trust. You know, what was this a reasonably, you know, reasonable price for a sale when you look at all the circumstances surrounding it? It's a forced sale. The legal landscape, reality is what the law was at that time is what the law was. And I think as this court put it pretty succinctly, a mistake in the interpretation of the law does not relieve them of their duties to protect their interest. I'm sure that was obviously that wasn't the exact language.
We have had some cases to follow on to Justice Kennedy's point. We've had some cases here where there's been trouble trying to identify whether there was a sale of the super priority interest, the dues owed on the super priority interest, or whether it was dues that went beyond that. It was unclear whether there was interest accumulating. It was unclear whether there were attorney's fees being charged. In the context of these sales, pre-SFR and pre-Shadowwood, shouldn't the court take those issues into consideration? I'm not sure that even the HOAs knew what they were selling before those cases.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree that the court shouldn't take them into consideration unless there is specific facts before the court to suggest that there was a problem or a dispute between the HOA and the lender, and then whether or not the seller or the buyer would have even known that.
So your position would be that given the uncertainty of the landscape, the lender who got notice should have at least inquired?
I think they should have inquired, and as this court put forth in SFR, they had a number. That wasn't the only thing they could have done. They could have paid under protest. They could have paid without reservation. They could have requested. They could have come to court the same way that many of the purchasers had to do, was come to court and get an injunction to stop the sale. So they could have said, hey, we're having problems. Let's go to court, get an injunction, stop the HOA from selling this, because there's a possibility that we could be wiped out.
I have a question. It seems to me fairly clear textually, if you don't have the Shadowwood problem of the lender having bought the property at the sale and then become, in effect, the owner, and you get complicated on the math in Shadowwood. But this was a straight-up lender, first deed of trust holder. And so the statute says they've got a super priority lien to the extent of 9 months of the HOA dues, whatever they are. Was there any effort to tender the 9 months and say, hey, go ahead with your sub-priority foreclosure, but we're paying you this and you need to stop. You don't have the right to foreclose.
There is no evidence in this record, and they brought forth nothing from their records to show in any way, shape, or form that they acted on these notices at all.
So there was no tender, no argument about tender, no, they didn't say, here's the money, HOA, that you need to, for your 9 months of dues?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
There was nothing.
So this is not a tender case?
This is not a tender case. And to the extent that the law was in flux at the time, to be clear, that while this was an early case, the sale actually in this case took place in 2013. This is after the NRED decision had been come out, the NRED opinion had come out, after all the litigation was going on, and quite honestly, to take into account that there's a flux in the law, or people don't know what's going on, and yet they're creating the very climate. Under, for example, BFP Resolution Trust, to creating the climate, the banks were litigating, does this statute even apply? Is there even a super priority lien that takes priority? They're litigating this, and then they want to complain about the prices when people go to have to take into account that they're probably going to have to go to court to defend what is their statutory right. And I don't think you get to use it as a sword and a shield. Quite honestly, this court interpreted SFR as it existed, the law. It wasn't new law, it was the statutes as they existed that day. And that's, therefore, there's no question. That's what the law was.
What would the tender amount have been? Does the record show that?
The record doesn't show that, Your Honor. But again, there was no effort at all on the part of the bank. At least there's nothing in the record at all on part of the bank to show this. And remember, they had 56F relief to show that they could have, whether or not they would be able to have some evidence of fraud, oppression, or unfairness.
So the bank didn't contact the HOA at any time to ask for a payoff amount on the super priority?
The bank, in its own records, could have brought forth evidence that they did that, and they brought forth nothing. The only thing they complain about here, other than, well, the notices which are required by statute don't tell me something, and post-sale conduct that has nothing to do with the actual sale and the conduct of the sale itself. So there's nothing in this record. Remember, these are records they would have had in their own possession and wouldn't have even needed 56F relief for, because they should have brought it out in the beginning if they had made a tender. They should have looked in the records at the first motion for summary judgment.
Was there any argument ever made by Navy Federal Credit Union that their federally organized credit unions of federal law should apply to transactions that they enter into? Did that ever come up?
They didn't make anything like that, and as they said, they have waived now the supremacy argument.
The supremacy clause argument, but that's been withdrawn, right?
Correct, Your Honor. So in this case, there is no evidence post 56F relief. While the court said there is nothing, you know, no commercial reasonableness, they actually took the Shadowwood standard and said, was it fraud, oppression, or unfairness that you can bring me evidence of? And they didn't. And to simply say we didn't know for sure what the law would mean is not enough to say that that is unfair. Because there were steps, they had actual notice. They were sent the notices as required by statute. And they were they took no action whatsoever, not one of the steps that this court laid out in the SFR decision as a possibility to even try to protect their interest. I think this is simply a case of a bank or a lender sitting on its rights and ignoring a notice that its collateral could be gone. Thank you, Your Honor. We've asked you to affirm.
Any further questions? Thank you. So, Wild, you have 2 minutes and 50 seconds.
Mr. Wild, can I ask you this, and coming back after hearing Ms. Gilbert's argument? Now, let's say we agreed with you that there was a genuine issue of material fact here regarding the sales price and all that. What exactly would you ask Judge Kadish to do? It sounds like nothing's been raised by your client on anything other than the sales price. So what is it that we would send back to Judge Kadish to consider?
I think my client should be given the opportunity to subpoena the HOA agent that cried the sale for the trial. And
what would that potentially show? If you're making an offer of proof, or what would you say? I mean, how's it going to change this case?
Well, we do have the accounting that is part of the record, and we would ask them what part of the lien that they were trying to sell, whether it was a priority lien or a sub-priority lien. Again, this is all done in the backdrop of the Rule 56 motion, and we would like the court to, we would like an opportunity to put evidence into the record at a trial to see exactly what they were selling. There's been a lot of discussion of fairness here, and I understand that's a wide net.
But if your client never made a demand before the sale to the HOA to provide you this information, isn't it a little late at this stage of the game to be asking for that?
It would be from a factual text, Your Honor, from a factual approach, and I agree. As stated, the fairness, it's a wide net. But I don't think at the time this was a mistake and a mistaken idea of what's going on in the law that my client had. And I think a way to look at the fairness issue is to look at the first test under the Chevron case, where the court considered whether or not to apply the law retroactively. And in this case, I'm not asking you to make that decision today. I think that you should wait until that's fully briefed and argued.
Does Chevron apply to interpretation of pre-existing statutory text?
That's correct. And that's
you believe it does? You believe Chevron applies to interpretation of pre-existing statutory text?
Yes, I do. And I think that looking at that, nobody could have guessed this. And again, that's my position. Others might argue.
Understand.
But this court itself was split in the SFAR decision. That was a 4-3 decision. The lower courts are split. I would estimate approximately 50-50. This court is split with the federal court on NRS 116. And again, finally, the Nevada legislature in 2015 completely revamped the statute. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gilbert and Mr. Wild, for your arguments in this matter. And this case is